1 John 1, verses 1 to 4. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we looked upon and have touched with our hands, concerning the word of life. The life was made manifest, and we have seen it, and we testify to it, and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father, and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. And we are writing these things so that our joy may be complete.
Better not to be dogmatic. No one likes a crazed fanatic. Here's a gal who's got her wits on the fence. That's where she sits, saying no one's right or wrong, indecisive for as long as possible. The agnostic. The word agnosticism, it comes from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge, and you put an A in front of it and it means not knowledge. So we say something's atypical when it's not typical, or something's asymmetrical when it's not symmetrical. You could say if you don't like bagpipes, you're a-Scottish. And if you're agnostic, it means that you don't know. You're just unsure when it comes to questions of God and Jesus and so on. And it's a very popular position because, well, for one thing, it sounds humble. Now, I'm not saying someone's 100% right. We're skeptical, aren't we, of the people who are a bit too sure. I guess in the city, if someone's very sure, it means either there's insider trading or they're bluffing. No one can be that certain. And so we're wary of religious people who are. Agnosticism is also peaceable, because people who are very sure that they're right end up in wars with other people who are very sure they're right. Now, Hindus in India and Muslims in Pakistan, or different kinds of Muslims, Sunni and Shia, or different kinds of Christians, Catholics and Protestants. You know, the people who are dogmatic about what they believe end up at war with others. Isn't it better just to say, I don't know, and I can live at peace with other people who don't know? It seems humble, it's peaceful, it's popular. Lots of famous agnostics. Let me give you a few of them. The authors, Franz Kafka and Matt Groening, as in the author of The Simpsons. That's more your thing. Or the tycoons, Elon Musk and Warren Buffett. The actors, Leonardo DiCaprio, Charlie Chaplin. The philosophers, Noam Chomsky, David Hume. The scientists, Marie Curie, Charles Darwin. All of them agnostics. Although few of them wrote explicitly to defend their agnosticism. And one exception is the broadcaster John Humphreys, who in 2008 wrote his book, In God We Doubt. He says this: "So my own spiritual journey, if that's not too highfalutin a notion, has taken me from my childish big questions to my ultimate failure to find any corresponding big answers. Along the way, I've experienced the indoctrination of confirmation classes, the anticlimax of the Eucharist, the futility of prayer, the contradiction between the promises made by an allegedly merciful, loving God and the reality of a suffering world. So I end up, so far at any rate, as a doubter." And yeah, maybe you can relate to that. Maybe that's you. And my aim this week and next week on Tuesday is to try and dislodge you from that position on the fence, which can be very comfortable. I want to begin by distinguishing different kinds of agnostic. It just means I don't know, but you can say I don't know, meaning different things, I guess. Firstly, you could be agnostic about something, you don't know about something, just because you haven't done the research, but you know that you could do the research. So I could say I'm agnostic about the neurological basis of ventriloquism. And that's true. I had a bit of an interest in that when I did a PhD over 20 years ago in the way that the brain processes sounds. And there was an interesting research paper published in 1994 that I read, but I haven't followed up on it since. I don't know whether the scientific community's got any further with the question, and so I'm agnostic. You know, I don't know, but I could know if I looked into it. The same way I could say that I'm agnostic about how many helium balloons it would take to send my mother into space. I mean, I could know, it's a fairly straightforward experiment, in fact, but it just doesn't seem very kind to find out. And it might be that you're agnostic about Christianity in that sense. You don't know, but you've just never looked into it. And so my suggestion is, given these questions are so important, why not just find out? And you know, there's lots of opportunities here at St. Helens and in the city to do that, to look at some of the eyewitness documents from the time of Jesus, to see what those who met him and saw him wrote. And we'll touch on that today, but I'd urge you just to find out, then you won't be agnostic anymore, then you'll know one way or the other. But there's a second kind of agnosticism that is a bit more entrenched than that. For this kind of agnostic, it's not just I don't know, but I can't know. But wait a minute, there is an awkward irony here, isn't it? Because type 2 agnostics actually aren't very agnostic about their own position. They're saying quite dogmatically, I know that you can't know. And I want to say, well, how are you so sure that you can't be sure? I mean, imagine I were to say, I know that there is no treasure hidden in Leicestershire. I mean, how could I know that? I would have to have first dug everywhere. What if there were a gold ingot hidden beneath an inconspicuous cabbage field? Or a diamond necklace inside the detergent bottle at a postcode that the police hadn't checked? I mean, it turns out that the University of Leicester Archaeological Services, who, let's face it, do more digging than the rest of us, didn't even know until recently that King Richard III was buried under their local car park. To be sure that something doesn't exist is actually tantamount to, or to be sure that you can't know if something exists is tantamount to a claim of absolute knowledge. And none of us have that. I think that's a bit of a silly argument. If at this point you're wondering about Heisenberg's uncertainty principle in quantum physics or Gödel's incompleteness theorem in Boolean algebra, I know I'm speaking to a subset of people now, then you also know that those things don't really apply to questions of God's existence and ultimate reality. And if the only Heisenberg that you know is the badass anti-hero from a Netflix drama about crystal meth, then you don't need to worry about it either. But that just leaves the type 3 agnostic, and I think maybe this is the most common, because type 3 agnosticism isn't so much a position as a strategy. I remember an unforgettable lecture when I was at theological college by the then principal, Mike Ovey. He walked into the lecture and he said, "The world is flat. Convince me otherwise." And then with a twinkle in his eye, he folded his arms and waited. And straight away, somebody said, "It looks round from space," which, you know, is quite a good first argument. And he said, "Oh no, NASA faked the photographs." Somebody else put their hand up. "The magnetic field is..." "Oh, no, no, you're just trying to bamboozle me with science," he said. And it went on for about 10 minutes, people trying everything they could. And whatever they said, he would just dodge it, even though he was dodging in an absurd way. And eventually, somebody said, "Look, it doesn't matter what arguments we make, you find any reason to dismiss them, even if you end up taking an absurd route." And a broad grin spread across his face. And he said, "Today's lecture is on skepticism, agnosticism. Shall we begin?" And his point was that for this kind of agnostic, actually agnosticism isn't a way of reaching the truth. It's actually a strategy to avoid reaching anything. It's a kind of philosophical handbrake that I put on to avoid having to be budged from the comfort of the status quo. Now, these are uncomfortable questions. What if there is a God? I remember asking this myself at university. What if there is a God who made me and the whole universe is here because he decided it would be here, and every breath that I breathe is a gift of his, and I spent half my life ignoring him? That's a big deal. It's uncomfortable. I don't like looking into this. What if when you die, it's not just that you decompose or you float off into the ether, but there really is a heaven and a hell? That's uncomfortable. And it's so uncomfortable that if I could find a way of not needing to think about it, I'd prefer that. And so I say, "I don't know. I don't know. I don't really want to know. Just leave me alone." Well, maybe you can relate to one of those three kinds of agnosticism. As I say, my aim today is to try and dislodge you from it. And I want to do it by looking at these verses from 1 John chapter 1. That which was from the beginning, which we've heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. The life was manifest, we've seen it, we testified to it, we proclaimed to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we have seen and heard, we proclaim also to you. Now, I think this is a really extraordinary paragraph. And I want to start here. I was actually had the opportunity of talking to a woman on the train recently on the way back from Leeds. And I was traveling in a carriage that had about 50 vicars in it. We'd just been at a big conference. And I was talking to her. I said, what do you do for a living? And she said, I'm a novelist. She said, what do you do? I said, I'm a vicar. She looked a bit surprised. I said, do you realise that almost everyone in this train carriage is a vicar? She's like, really? She's like, yeah. So there's a slightly surreal train journey for her. And we got talking about it, and she said, well, it depends what you're kind of agnostic about, because surely you can be into spiritual reality but not really into Jesus. Or you could be into Jesus but not really into the Bible. Or you could be into the Bible but not really into the church. You know, so where do we even start? And I want to argue that at least a sensible place to start is with the letters of the New Testament. If we're asking questions about Jesus, then why not start with somebody who knew Jesus very well personally, like this guy John? It's a good starting point, I think. And yet John writes to these other Christians in the first century maybe one of the most extraordinary paragraphs ever written. And to try and help you see why it's so strange, I want to begin by a trip that I made to the White Cube Gallery in Bermondsey. Anyone? If you like modern art, it's great. They change exhibitions about every 3 months. Always some really quirky things. I went just before lockdown, and they had an exhibition of 350 paintings by Peter Dreyer, the celebrated German artist. Each measured 10 by 8 inches. Each depicted the same empty glass of water. He sketched the same glass almost daily since 1974. And that is quirky, right? So all these almost identical pictures, but slightly different refractions of light and so on. And then, of course, to go with the exhibition, there comes the profound philosophical insights of the curator, and you get it written about in the notes. So we were told that Dreyer's studies of matter, time, and light demonstrate an artist's meditative focus can reveal great fullness even in an empty glass. You know, this kind of philosophical insight into questions of light and life and ultimate reality and stuff, that's kind of normal. Go to any art gallery, you'll find stuff like that. Or listen to any Bob Dylan song, you'll find stuff like that. People grappling with the nature of human beings and reality in the future, and that's normal. Meanwhile, my stepbrother works for a concert hall in Essex. And I checked his Facebook the other day and discovered that he'd been for a pint at the Stag and Lantern, a microbrewery in Hymes Park. Apparently it's quite good. That's kind of normal, isn't it? People writing on social media what they've done in their day, where they went, who they bumped into, and so on. But those two kinds of literature, if we can call them that, they kind of exist on different planes. You'd never hear someone saying, oh, last night I went into a micro pub and I met eternity. What? I mean, is that just someone with an unusual name? You know, he has mystical parents. Or you'll never guess who walked into the office on Monday afternoon. The beginning of the universe. Right? That's what John is saying. It's actually quite odd. That which was from the beginning, the ultimate source of everything, which we've seen with our eyes. We've looked upon, touched with our hands, concerning the word of life. The life, the essence of life. Yeah, the life, well, it was made manifest. We saw it, we testified to it. And what John is talking about is his encounter with Jesus Christ. But I want you to think about it for a moment. We can be agnostic. How do I know about questions of ultimate reality and life and the beginning and everything? They're difficult things to get to the bottom of. But for John, it was just a guy that he'd spent 3 years with. Oh yeah, I met him. I saw him. I went on fishing trips with him. I talked to him. I know life. And of course, you can have a lot more certainty about encounters you've had with people than you can about abstract philosophical questions. If you said, you know, someone said, oh, I wonder what Andrew Sachs, who is Andrew Sachs? What's he like? He says, oh, I don't know. I mean, how could we ever find out? I mean, maybe he's 4'5" and has shocks of red hair. And someone says, oh, no, I think he's about 6'2" and he's bald. Oh, well, how could we ever know, you say, right? But of course, now you can. I mean, I could have faked my passport, I suppose, but, you know, you could do some checks and find, am I really Andrew Sachs? Well, now you know that the ginger-haired short guy theory of Andrew Sachs is wrong because you've met him. Here I am. If I said, oh, how sure are you that Andrew Sachs is bald? I mean, you're pretty sure, aren't you? It could be in a sort of expensive one of those actor's wigs, but it's not. You can pull my scalp afterwards if you want to be really sure. Encounters with people you can be sure about. But for John, his encounters with this person was an encounter with eternal life itself. And you've got to ask yourself, what leads you to that conclusion? Right, this isn't John just having had a dream in a cave and come up with a theory about God. This isn't John just doing some experiments in a laboratory. This is John spending 3 years of his life in close proximity with Jesus Christ and concluding at the end of it, this guy is the essence of life and the beginning of the universe and the creator of all. Now, what would it take to convince you of that? Now, I say, we've met for, well, I've met some of you before, but I've met some of you for about 15 minutes so far. That is, I suggest, already sufficient time for you to conclude quite certainty that I am not God, right? I mean, you know, I struggle even to tie my tie this morning. That's how long it's been with lockdown, plus the fact that I've got fatter and my 16-inch shirts don't actually do up around the top button. So, you know, incompetence over even basic tasks. But if you spent 3 years of your life with me, you would be very sure I was not God. And John spent 3 years of his life with Jesus and was very sure that he was God. And I want you at least to be curious about that. I mean, he was so sure of it that he would stake his life on it. The early Christians went to enormous lengths and were persecuted and threatened, and some of them were executed for their testimony about Jesus. And they were sure enough to maintain their testimony until their deaths. What convinced him? That's what got me curious about it in the first place. I went to university having, my only encounter really with Jesus was with stained glass windows in churches and old hymns. I'd never really kind of considered these questions as historical things. But I realized this is the question. There was somebody 2,000 years ago called Jesus Christ. Who was he? And some of the people around him were convinced that they'd met the creator of the universe. And were they right? You know, was he the creator of the universe? And how would they know? And I'd love to invite you to read some of their biographies of Jesus with that question in mind. What did they see that persuaded them? What did they see and hear and touch that led them to that conclusion? And actually, there's a clue, I think, in verse 1. He says, that which we've seen, which we've looked upon, and have touched with our hands. Now, of course, you know, they did touch Jesus because they had meals with him and they went on fishing trips with him. But I wonder whether John has a specific incident in mind when he touched Jesus. Namely, the most famous agnostic of the Bible, a man called Doubting Thomas. He was a friend of John, so I want to call him Agnostic Thomas. Thomas, the patron saint of agnostics everywhere. Actually, that's not true. He's actually the patron saint of architects and builders, but that doesn't seem as immediately relevant to today. But remember, famously, Thomas doubted that Jesus could have been resurrected from the dead. They'd all seen him be killed, butchered by the Romans on a cross. You know the story on the first Good Friday. They were really sure he was dead, and John, in his account, narrates how the soldiers had speared Jesus' side, and out had come a mixture of blood and water, which my medic friends tell me is a sign of heart failure and the fluid that gathers around the pericardium and the pleural cavity leaking out. It's pretty certain evidence that Jesus was dead. They know that. They watched Jesus be buried. And then the report started to spread on Easter Sunday. We've seen him. We've seen Jesus resurrected. And Thomas says, oh, I can't believe that. I can't believe in a resurrection unless I were to able to examine him in the same way as I am inviting you to examine my bald head. You know, check it's not a wig. How could you be really sure? Well, you could tug at my scalp. That's the kind of visceral examination that Thomas wants. I want to actually put my fingers in the holes where they put the nails at the crucifixion. And the place where they speared his side, I want to put my finger in there, my hand in there. And Jesus says, okay, sure. Jesus appears to him and invites him to perform that exact examination. And he does. And he becomes sure. I mean, how reasonable would it be for Thomas to remain agnostic after that? No, it's not reasonable at all, is it? I mean, you might be agnostic about philosophical things. Thomas was not agnostic, having witnessed someone die and personally checked that they were then alive again. And it's actually a very good test, isn't it? Because by examining the crucifixion scars, not only is he verifying that Jesus is alive, but he's also checking it's the same person that they killed. So it's a sort of double evidence. And he's sure. And John says, that which we've seen with our eyes, we've looked upon and touched with our hands concerning life. Let me tell you, no, we had our doubts, but then this happened. He died and he was alive again and we were there. And so we're certain. But I want to finish with verse 4, just at the end of our paragraph from 1 John. Because John goes on to say, we're writing these things that our joy may be complete. I think the reason why agnosticism maybe is so popular is because people have a fear that Jesus, if he's real, God, if he's there, would want to wreck our life. You know, there's a suspicion that God would suck the joy out of the room. He'd limit my choices. He'd spoil everything. If Christianity had a color, it would be gray. If you could sum up the Christian ethic in a word, it would be don't. Being a Christian means ill-advised fashion choices, you know, socks and sandals, classically. A wine cellar stocked only with Schlur, which one of my friends calls Christian champagne. Substituting your favourite Netflix thriller for back-to-back repeats of Songs of Praise on VHS, which suddenly you're supposed to love because you're into... Yeah, that is the stereotype, isn't it? It's why... a few years ago, a load of atheists got together and put together £150,000 to put on the side of buses the campaign, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy life. A friend of mine told me how surprised he was to read of Jesus' first miracle narrated in John's Gospel, in John's biography of Jesus, where Jesus goes to a wedding and they run out of wine. And Jesus turns water into wine. And my friend says he was very surprised about this. And it wasn't just that the chemistry is ordinarily impossible. You know, H2O to C2H5OH plus the subtle combinations of tannins and vanillins and so on can't be done in the chemistry lab. But, you know, why shouldn't the God who made the universe do some party tricks? Now, the surprising thing for him was that God wasn't instead going around the weddings of the world turning all the wine into water. That's what he'd expected. And yet here is Jesus creating the equivalent of more than 800 bottles of Chateau Neuf du Pape to help a party keep going into the small hours. It's just not the stereotype. Now, the Bible's against drunkenness, sure. And so am I, having seen a very close friend die of alcohol abuse. And it can destroy people's lives. And if you know that, you won't be pro it either. But enjoyment and fun and life and creation, God couldn't be more pro that. He invented it after all. And here is Jesus, God himself, stepping into the world to reveal life. In front of eyewitnesses, doing miracles that prove, that persuade John and his friends that this is the author of life. Showing people that they've nothing to fear from embracing life. But rather, as John puts it, we'll have fellowship, we'll have a friendship, a deep personal friendship with God, our creator. And he says, we're writing these things that our joy might be complete. If you're on the fence right now, I want to try and persuade you. It's an uncomfortable place to be. And I know with a bit of memory foam, it can be bearable, but eventually the splinters are going to start to dig in. And you're missing out on something amazing. The God who made you, the life for which he made you, all expressed to you in God's own Son, come to earth in real history with real witnesses who really saw and heard and touched him. And you can be sure without throwing away your brain, and it's really good news. You can be sure, and you can be happy as well as sure. Well, I'm grateful for you listening. This is a two-parter, as Wes said. They kind of stand alone, so I mean, I hope that makes sense as a message, but it's only really part one. I'd love you to come to part two. Part two, we're going to see why it might actually be dangerous to be agnostic. And please invite others. It will also be standalone, but if you hear both, then it makes a set. So thank you very much for listening. I'm going to hand back over to Wes as we close.